This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. This hour, a trip around the world fueled only by solar power. We visit the world's largest solar-powered boat docked right here in New York City after successfully traveling around the world. Plus, your greatest, most outlandish fears about how the world might end. Humorist John Hodgman is with us here on his new special on Netflix called Ragnarok. But we begin in Afghanistan, where peace talks with the Taliban have already faced their first hurdle. On Tuesday, the U.S. military handed over control of security operations to Afghan forces and announced they would meet with the Taliban to begin the process of peace talks. But just hours later, the Taliban launched a deadly ambush on an American convoy. Meanwhile, Afghan officials separately announced they were ceasing cooperation with the United States over the transition of power there. It all comes as the Taliban rose their flag in Qatar ribbon, inaugurating their new offices in Qatar, which they've called the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, where peace talks would take place if they ever got started. President Obama, speaking in Berlin earlier today, said he hasn't given up hope that peace talks are possible. Listen.
We still believe that you've got to have a parallel track to at least look at the prospect of some sort of political reconciliation.
With us on the line now from Kabul, the BBC's Bilal Sowari. Welcome.
Hi.
Give us the latest, please, in this confusing scenario.
Well, first of all, the Taliban announced the opening of their political office. A Taliban spokesman speaking live on Al Jazeera said that the reason for the opening of that office was to end the occupation, to liberate Afghanistan. And at no point did they mention that they were ready to talk to the Afghan government. They did not discuss peace talks with President Karzai's government. That has really angered President Karzai and his government. And the fact that there was a Taliban flag flying and that the office was named the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Now, President Karzai's position is that such a thing does not exist. His office says that he was opposed to that and that the Americans had given him guarantees and writings that those would be not mentioned. But his office says that the Taliban office was named the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. There was a flag, and the Taliban did indeed talk about bloodshed and fighting.
Bilal Sowari, it seems like what the Taliban is doing with this new office is trying to achieve international political legitimacy similar to what the PLO achieved in its struggle against Israel, and that Hamid Karzai is sort of in the Israeli position, not wanting this organization to get its own recognition as sort of an international political force.
Well, President Karzai's position is that the Taliban must come and talk to the Afghan government as Afghans, that this should be a totally Afghanized peace process, and that the Taliban should stop talking of more bloodshed and killing. What has angered President Karzai is that the Taliban have really strayed from the original agreement in writing which they had with the Afghan government. Now, in the past, the Taliban have always called President Karzai's government a puppet government, a government brought in by Western forces. But President Karzai has been saying, well, now the entire country is in the hands of the Afghan National Security Forces. The country has an Afghan government. It has an Afghan parliament. And he would really like the Taliban to talk to the Afghan government rather than to the Americans. In a few weeks back, the presidential palace was very critical, saying that the Taliban's messages were brought in by the Americans to the Afghan government.
A setback before peace talks even start, President Obama warned this road would be bumpy, and he was probably more correct than even he knew. Bilal Sowari, reporter for the BBC in Kabul, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we want to take a minute now and explore this idea of talking to your enemy and whether the Afghan government should engage in talks with the Taliban. On the line with us now is Kurt Volker, former U.S. permanent representative to NATO. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Also with me in the studio, Kristen Rouse, an Army veteran of the Afghanistan War. She served three tours of duty in that country since 2006. Hi.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Kurt, let me start with you and play you this cut from the president himself and set up what is a really difficult scenario for the United States and for the government of Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan. Listen.
This is an important first step towards reconciliation. Although it's a very early step, we anticipate there will be a lot of bumps in the road.
Kurt Volker, whenever the president of the United States issues the premise that there will be a lot of bumps in the road, he has to be expecting the kind of violence and hiccups that we've experienced just in the last 24 hours?
Sure. The violence and also, I think, the standoffs in negotiations that are going to prevent agreement. I think that the way I would think of this is that it's always worth having the door open and being willing to talk and seeing whether your opponent is willing to come to any kind of reasonable agreement about the future of Afghanistan. But I think we also have to expect that that's not what the Taliban's going to do. They have been fighting, willing to kill and maim and everything to gain control of Afghanistan again. Now they know that we're leaving. We've announced that. We've set this deadline out there for many years. They are going to be staying and we'll be gone. So they see that this is turning their way. So I think it's very unlikely that they're going to actually negotiate in any meaningful way.
One has to ask Kurt Volker, and people have asked this, not my original idea, about what we really have to offer the Taliban at this point that they would want. I mean, of course, they're going to be negotiating in public view with the Afghan government, the government of Hamid Karzai, but of course the United States is going to be involved. Do we have anything to entice them with?
Well, I think the one thing that comes up is what was already in the report that we just heard, which is this idea of legitimacy. Thus far, we in the international community, NATO, the Afghan government, and it really in the eyes of many of the Afghan people, the Taliban has been seen as illegitimate, that they should not be running Afghanistan and they should join the process of building a new Afghanistan and recognize the Constitution, stop violence, things like that. If they get legitimacy as they are, without having to do any of those things, I do think that's something that they get out of this.
Kristen Rouse, this is a good point to turn to you, because the idea of legitimacy for an organization that you spent three tours fighting in Afghanistan, you and tens of thousands of your comrades, has to sound like a bit of a difficult idea. How do you think of the idea of legitimacy for the Taliban at this point?
Well, Todd, the Taliban has been just a brutal, ruthless enemy for 12 years, at least for us. The Taliban has been responsible for over 2,000 American deaths, for hundreds of coalition forces' deaths. Their attacks have been even more deadly for Afghan army and Afghan police, and they've had targeted assassinations of the men and women working in the Afghan government at every level. They've assassinated former President Rabbani as he was trying to lead the peace process in 2011. They have targeted innocent civilians and aid workers, and they've even targeted children going to school. That's one of the memories that that most struck me from my first tour in 2006.
Meanwhile, all of those things true, all part of your experience and all horrible, but at the end of this long war, eradication is not an option. So we have to deal with them on some level, and I wonder how you sort of approach that cognitively.
Well, and it's absolutely true that fighting is not fighting alone will not end the war or the conflict in Afghanistan for either the U.S. or for the Afghan people. And so it's been very important for the U.S. to include diplomatic teams alongside troops, to have USAID in there, to have a lot of different non-lethal efforts embedded in with the American military effort as well. And so maybe there is something worth talking about with the Taliban, but as they've shown, they've been absolutely ruthless. They've been willing to say a lot and to say, "Oh, we're the legitimate government of Afghanistan." Meanwhile, they're killing many of their own people, to include women and children.
Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador, former U.S. representative to NATO, rather, do we need to differentiate the Taliban political leadership, such as it is, cutting ribbons in Qatar with a new political office, and an insurgent attack that took place just overnight? Is it possible that there are factions of insurgents who want no part of this, and it's not necessarily on the orders of Mullah Omar, or do we need to put them all in one camp?
Right. Well, I think your question is to say, look, the Taliban is not a monolithic and easily centrally controlled entity. I think that's right. So this group that has opened the office in Qatar probably doesn't have direct control over all of the forces that the Taliban would claim are Taliban forces and resistance in Afghanistan. At the same time, they do share a general commitment to a common ideology and a general commitment to fighting against the Afghan government, which they view as illegitimate, they view as a puppet, and to fighting against the international forces that are there. And I do think that, again, we're looking at this from an American perspective. We'd like to negotiate a way out of this. From a Taliban perspective, they're looking at winning. They're looking at having succeeded in what they've been trying to do for the last 12 years of ousting the Afghan government, ousting the international forces that are there. Opening the office in Qatar and continuing attacks inside Afghanistan are part of the same thing. They're not contradictory.
Kristen Rouse, I want to finish with you because having been on the ground there, you're a warrior. And you, as we just talked about, you know that eradication isn't an option in the real world. But are you willing to talk about how this makes you feel, your government sponsoring political negotiations with such a brutal regime as the Taliban?
Well, we've been fighting the Taliban, but we've also been partnering with the Afghan people to build a peace that will last. And so I think more than anything, I want to see an opportunity for peace there, but peace with justice. And my hope is that that is the end, that will be the ends that we're trying to reach there.
Do you think that Hamid Karzai is a good broker on the Afghan side to achieve that?
I honestly can't speak to that. He's had a very long and colored history in Afghanistan, and I know that there are many honest brokers there. I've had the honor of working with a number of Afghan army soldiers and officers, and there are people in Afghanistan who are genuinely seeking justice, fairness, and good governance in their country.
It's a long history of having to negotiate with your enemies to settle a war when eradication isn't an option. And it's the case now in Afghanistan, or maybe. Kristen Rouse, three-tour Army veteran of Afghanistan. Kurt Volker, former U.S. permanent representative to NATO. Thank you both.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Later this hour, comedian and humorist John Hodgman is with us, making his predictions on doomsday scenarios. But he says, don't worry, justice will carry on.
As a doomsday expert and Ragnarok predictor, I am certain that there is a plan in place, a contingency to get all of those Supreme Court justices to safety.
I'm sure that you're right.
Right? Don't you think there's a secret Supreme Court Hall of Justice in orbit that they will be immediately teleported to?
One hopes it's not underground.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's got to be in orbit so that there can be justice from space.
Justice from space with John Hodgman. But how about the rest of us? We're asking you for your most outlandish, outrageous doomsday scenarios.
The solar system could float through a massive dust cloud that could completely black out all sunlight for millions of years.
It's an alien invasion. I think little swarms of little gray men will enslave the human population for their own selfish purposes. And let's hope that never happens.
The world is going to end in such a way where the moon's orbit is going to collapse and the moon is going to collide with Earth and kind of knock us into the sun.
The moon colliding with Earth, knocking us into the sun and knocking the Supreme Court into a spinning trajectory through outer space. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's coming up later here on The Takeaway. Well, the recent death of longtime New Jersey Senator, Democrat Frank Lautenberg, and Democratic Senator John Kerry, and his move to Secretary of State have left two vacancies in the Senate. Both New Jersey and Massachusetts are about to fill those seats with special elections. New Jersey in October, probably. And in Massachusetts next week, our partner WGBH hosted the final debate between the Massachusetts candidates last night, Republican contender Gabriel Gomez and Democratic Congressman Ed Markey. R.D. Saul is a longtime Boston news anchor and Boston University journalism professor who moderated the final Massachusetts Senate debate. Hi, R.D.
Hi, how are you, Todd? Nice to be with you.
Just fine, thanks. And with me in the studio, Sarah Gonzalez, Northern New Jersey Enterprise reporter for Takeaway, co-producer WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
R.D., let's start in Massachusetts with you. Ed Markey has the lead, as you would expect, for a longtime Massachusetts congressman. But this race has gotten nasty, of course.
Well, there's been a lot of vitriol over the last couple of weeks in particular. Gabriel Gomez saying he's a new kind of Republican. Markey saying not so. It's the same old tired Republican ideas, picking up on Gabriel Gomez's positions on assault weapons, on abortion rights in the Supreme Court, and his record in business with Advent International, an investment firm. On the other side, Gomez saying, you've got a 37-year incumbent in Ed Markey. He's part of the problem, not the answer.
Let's listen to part of that RD from your debate last night, an exchange between Markey and Gomez, talking surprisingly about another senator. Listen.
Congressman, you've been down there for 37 years, and, I mean, the president's got term limits. Don't you believe that congressmen and senators should be term limited?
Mr. Gomez, you just had John McCain in campaigning for you 3 weeks ago. Did you ask John McCain to leave the Senate? You have Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, the Republican leader in the Senate, raising money for you across the country. Did you ask Mitch McConnell to tell him that it's time for him to leave the Senate as part of your ability to get support from them to help you in this campaign? No, Mr. Gomez, you did not.
Yes, I did.
No, you did not.
R.D. Saul, Ed Markey wants to tie Gabriel Gomez, who's a new kind of Republican, to the old guard of Republicans, Mitch McConnell and John McCain.
Well, absolutely. And in Massachusetts, you can't run as a McConnell Republican and expect to win anything. This is the land of the... This is a blue state, Todd. If you're going to run as a Republican here, you've got to run as a moderate Republican in the mold of Weld and Scott Brown and Mitt Romney when he ran for governor.
Meanwhile, what is the White House doing? What are Democrats doing to make sure they don't have another Scott Brown scenario on their hand? We all remember not too long ago when Massachusetts was a blue state and they can't lose. And look, Scott Brown got elected to the Senate as a Republican.
Well, they've ramped up the game. Look who's been in town for Ed Markey. The President of the United States, the First Lady of the United States, and in Massachusetts just in the last several days, Bill Clinton. You don't get bigger guns than that, I think. And may I just throw in one other point here?
Yeah, please do.
Who in their right mind would decide to hold an election for the United States Senate on June 25th, out of sequence, and in the summer vacation season? Here's what the situation is. Back in 2004, when Mitt Romney was governor, he's a Republican, Democrats were pretty confident that John Kerry would win the presidency. They didn't want Romney appointing a Republican to that seat. So they passed a law creating a special election rule, 145 to 160 days, that's the window, after the vacancy, you have to have the election. We have a special election just before the 4th of July. Who is paying attention? That's going to be a real interesting thing to see what turnout is on Tuesday.
They're having much the same issue in New Jersey, Artie Saul from Boston University Journalism Department and news anchor. Artie, thank you up there in Boston. And let's now turn this around on Sarah Gonzalez from WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. They're having a similar situation in New Jersey with Governor Chris Christie's controversial decision to hold a special election for the Senate seat, Frank Lautenberg's Senate seat, just a few days, a few weeks before the general election at the cost of $26 million.
Yeah, so Christie decided to hold a special election 3 weeks before his own reelection. And this week, lawyers who argued that Christie didn't have the discretion to schedule the special election at this time have filed briefs asking the New Jersey Supreme Court to intervene. And, you know, Christie was kind of in a difficult situation. He had the choice to either hold a special election or appoint someone to fill the late Frank Lautenberg Senate seat. And he didn't want, you know, to rally Democrats if he held the election for the Senate seat on the same day that he was running for governor again.
Right. Now, we have to talk candidates. And really, New Jersey's also a blue state. And on the Democratic side, really, in terms of publicity, it's really all Cory Booker all the time right now, the Democratic mayor of Newark. He's not the only candidate. There are other Democrats running in the primary.
Yeah, and when you look at the polls, Cory Booker does have the lead. He's expected to get more than 50% of the votes. The next candidate in line, depending on the poll, is either Rush Holt or Frank Pallone.
And these are both congressmen.
Both congressmen, veteran congressmen, and they come in at about 9 to 10% of the vote. So there's a pretty big gap there. And Todd, there's a fourth person in the race, Sheila Oliver. She's the current New Jersey Assembly Speaker, and she's been compared to Cory Booker a lot. She's also an African-American who is from the same county as Cory Booker. And some people have said that she was encouraged to run so that she could split the Cory Booker votes. She says she's running for a different reason. And one of those is that New Jersey has never sent a woman to the U.S. Senate. And so she is hoping to be the first.
There are a couple of Republican candidates. The most important Republican in this race, even though he's not running, is Chris Christie. But the governor hasn't endorsed the leading Republican yet.
No, and I don't think he made a statement recently that he's not going to endorse anyone, but that he will support the Republican candidates in whatever way he can.
So we have two Senate races, New Jersey and Massachusetts, both in a way less about the candidates perhaps and more about timing and political advantage in election law, both in New Jersey and Massachusetts. That's Sarah Gonzalez, Northern New Jersey Enterprise reporter for The Takeaway, co-producer WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Also joined by R.D. Saul, longtime Boston news anchor and Boston University professor who moderated last night's debate. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The laundromat is completely shut down, which constitutes a large portion of our income.
We can't flush the toilet in the clinic. I mean, that's a huge deal for the Department of Health. We don't have running water because, you know, washing our hands after we touch patients, and that's a huge issue.
Running out of water, that's become a reality in Magdalena, a village in Socorro County in New Mexico. It's a village of just about 1,000 people. The voices there from a nurse practitioner who works at a local clinic and the owner of a local laundromat. Now, residents had only 24 hours notice before the tap water was shut off. Fronteras reporter Monica Ortiz-Uribe went to Magdalena to speak to residents about the drought. She joins us today from Las Cruces, New Mexico. Welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. And let me play you the voice of Steve Bailey, a local utility manager, talking to you about the aquifer, the underground water in Magdalena. Listen.
Looks like what has happened is our aquifer disappeared on us. We were at a certain depth a year ago, and that depth is 15 feet lower than what it was.
Monica Ortiz-Uribe, the aquifer disappeared on them? What happened?
Yes. So this is one of those stories that you read the headlines and you just have to do a double take. You're like, am I really reading about this situation? So about a week before Steve Bailey went and checked on the aquifer, residents were noticing that their water was getting a little cloudy. So they called him up and they say, hey, we think we got a problem. That's when he went out and checked the city's one well. It's their one underground water well that supplied the city with their water. And he goes and he checks in it and he looks, holy cow, it's dropped 15 feet since last year. And he was telling me that normally they averaged a drop of only 1 foot per year. So they were thinking they still had at least a good decade on this well, and they were not expecting this.
Is there any form of valid scientific explanation other than overuse? I mean, 15 feet in a year is unheard of.
Right. Well, I mean, the situation is twofold. One thing that I didn't get to touch on in the story was that, yes, this was the only operational well that the city had. For years, they knew that if this well gave up, they would have no backup option. But there was never any money, according to the city officials, to put in a backup well. And so they let it go as is, and knowing that, you know, if this one well gave up one day, they would be in trouble. But again, they thought they had more time than they actually did. But then you throw in the drought, and with the drought, you have a situation where our underground aquifers are being used up faster than they can replenish themselves. So the combination of poor administration and the drought led to this situation.
So I have to know before we go, Monica Ortiz-Uribe, a lot of dusty people who aren't taking baths, a lot of water trucks coming into town. What's it look like?
Yes. Well, you know, they're in a much better situation. They since have a temporary solution, and they have running water now. But when I arrived, people were using porta potties. It was nearing 100 degrees out there. Restaurants were using paper plates and plastic utensils. It was hot and miserable.
Monica Ortiz-Uribe is a reporter from Fronteras who went to Magdalena in New Mexico to talk about a disappearing aquifer there. Monica, have you been able to get yourself a drink?
Yes, thankfully, and I appreciate it all the more.
I would too if I were out there. Monica Ortiz-Uribe from Fronteras. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, from a desert to a floodplain where the water problems are very, very different. FEMA has released new maps with big consequences for homeowners along the coast in New Jersey. In the aftermath of Sandy, FEMA flood maps required many homeowners and business owners to elevate their structures and pay or risk paying higher insurance rates. But revised maps for New Jersey are out. They've greatly reduced the number of homes located in the at-risk zone. And while homeowners may be relieved, environmentalists, well, they're not so happy. With us is Scott Gurian, Sandy recovery reporter for New Jersey Spotlight and New Jersey Public Radio. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Todd.
So, Scott, just to start off, let us in on the significance of the maps. It's quite a thing that a new map could come out and so many homeowners and business owners in New Jersey could be so relieved.
Right. Well, Todd, tourism is such a big business and a vital part of the economy of the Jersey Shore, so much so that $25 million of the federal aid money that New Jersey received after Sandy is being devoted to an ad campaign to bring people back. So there's been this enormous rush to rebuild and get as much back up and running as soon as possible. And people needed to know how to go about the rebuilding just so that they would rebuild their homes, rebuild boardwalks and so forth. And all of this wouldn't just easily get washed away during the next storm. So FEMA released this mapping data, even though it wasn't complete. They wanted to just get this data out there as soon as possible to give people some general guidance as far as how high to rebuild. And now that these new maps have been released, people are much relieved that the cost of rebuilding will be not quite as expensive in many cases, or the cost of insurance won't be as expensive as they'd feared.
So does this mean that a whole lot of people can just pay slightly less on premiums, or a whole lot less in some cases?
It means that they won't have to raise up their buildings as high in many of these places that FEMA has readjusted its engineering data and found that the waves won't be coming in quite as high, crashing along the shore in some areas as they first thought. And I spoke to several people, including Jeff Tittle, who's the director of the New Jersey Sierra Club. He said he agrees with many of these revisions, but he's also kind of fears that they may have been influenced by political pressure, pressure from people who didn't like the original maps. And he and other environmentalists feel that maybe they may have gone too far in the other direction.
We should be looking at doing things the best cost-effective ways possible, not just what's politically expedient, not what's just as quickest and easiest. And that is a concern, because I think for people along the coast, they don't want to go through this again. And if you don't rebuild in a better way now, well, you will. Even if you elevate your house 6 feet and it turns out to storm 7 feet, you got a problem.
Tittle's main concern is, he put it this way, he said it's like driving down the highway going 80 miles an hour, only looking in the rearview mirror. And the reason he said that is because these maps don't actually take into effect the flooding that was caused specifically by Sandy, nor do they look at sea level rise or what scientists predict is an increased risk for more severe storms, you know, this question of climate change. And FEMA itself acknowledges, yes, these concerns are valid. But I spoke to Bill McDonnell, who's FEMA's regional mitigation director. He says that there's nothing keeping states or individual communities from going above and beyond FEMA's elevations.
When it comes to global warming or climate change, that is ultimately a decision that the states and local communities need to make. So if they're looking at our product as a minimum standard, they can always be more restrictive. The higher they go and the safer they are, ultimately the more resilient they'll be, and they could be saving money and insurance premiums down the road.
Scott Gurian, before we let you go, are people in New Jersey feeling like they're going to be able to make some money this summer?
People are certainly trying. A lot of the shore has been rebuilt at this point, is back up and running. The problem is, again, there's been this focus kind of on the short term and looking at more of the long term. New Jersey and these communities could have built above, way far above and beyond these FEMA elevations. State of New Jersey is required that they build just 1 foot above the elevations. Environmentalists in many cases are saying that's not enough. And Governor Christie has in the past not been interested in including climate change as a factor in the planning of the rebuilding of the shore.
Scott Gurian is Sandy recovery reporter for New Jersey Spotlight and New Jersey Public Radio. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The waves of the Hudson River crashed against the pier in downtown Manhattan yesterday as the world's largest solar boat docked in the North Cove Marina. It's been a 284-day voyage. It's visited 28 countries, crossed 3 oceans and 11 seas, and get this, on almost no fossil fuel.
It looks like a floating platform. It does not have sails, unfortunately, which I missed, but basically it's to prove that you can actually sail around the world just using solar.
Now, the boat's sheer size attracted the attention of tourists and passersby, workers, with the upper deck covered with 5,554 square feet of solar paneling. The MS Turner Planet Solar kind of looks like an aircraft carrier, but it's the first such boat to complete a trip around the world exclusively using solar energy. It's now sailing along the Gulf Stream as part of a scientific expedition organized by the University of Geneva in Switzerland. We went down and visited the boat yesterday while it was docked here in New York City, and I spoke with Captain Gerard Dabaville and members of the expedition team. Captain, we're standing in a little berth on the deck of the ship, and I'm looking at dozens and dozens of what appear to be 1 meter square solar panels.
Yes, a bit less. They are 80 centimeters by 80, and I don't even know how many there are, but we have a total of more than 500 meters. As we are not navigating, we are consuming a little bit with all the instruments on board, but our batteries are totally charged.
If the sun goes away completely, like you can be at sea and have overcast conditions mm-hmm. for many, many days, of course, how many days of power does this boat have?
We have about 72 hours of battery power reserve that we can use. If I foresee that the sun will be out for several days, then I reduce the speed so we don't consume much. If we go slowly, we consume very little. If we go fast, we consume a lot. So it's really an exercise of energy management.
How does this boat handle, you know, its performance, its ease of use? Obviously, it's not as fast as some boats, but that's okay. But how does it stack up?
Generally speaking, the boat is not very fast. Average speed when we crossed the Atlantic was 5.5 knots, which is not bad, not tremendous. The boat is also an ambassador of solar energy. And the boat, as you saw, is used for press conference, for meeting, for reception. It's not luxury, but it's big enough and comfortable, more comfortable than many boats I have been.
I'm sure you've been on much worse, I imagine.
Well, in 1980, a long time ago, I crossed the Atlantic from Cape Cod to France on a rowing boat, 5 meters long. So this is a bit more comfortable.
Under the power of your own arms or somebody else's?
Yes, nothing else.
Well, we appreciate your time in doing so and for allowing us on your bridge.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. After a short tour of the thoroughly modern boat, we sat down to talk climate change with leaders of the scientific expedition.
My name is Martin Beniston. I'm a professor at the University of Geneva. I head the Institute for Environmental Science, and I'm a climatologist by training.
My name is Bastian Ebelings. I'm also a professor at the University of Geneva. I'm an ecologist by training, and I focus on small things, microbes, in water.
So this ship, gentlemen, as the captain explained to us, is an ambassador for solar power, obviously for clean locomotion. There's nothing special about this ship that's critical to your scientific mission, except as an excellent ambassador for low-carbon transportation, I assume.
Well, there is one detail that is interesting because the ship doesn't emit any pollution, is that in some of the atmospheric measurements that we'll be making once we're out in the open ocean, we'll be sure that what we're measuring is of natural origin and not biased by the exhaust fumes of a traditional ship's chimney, for example.
And what is the nature of your research on the ship? What kind of results are you going after?
If everything goes well, there'll be some quite novel measurements coming out of this expedition, in particular related to what the ocean emits in terms of aerosols, these fine particles that remain in suspension in the atmosphere that are released by the ocean through breaking waves, for example, and that can have different climate impacts according to the size and the nature of the particles that are in the atmosphere.
And what we aim to do with our work on this boat is to link what's happening in the ocean to what's happening in the atmosphere. Globally, primary production, which is the amount of carbon being fixed by phytoplankton in the ocean, is going down. And it's going down because of the way climate change is changing the ocean. If phytoplankton growth changes in the ocean, then also the production of aerosols by the ocean will change. It's climate change that's changing both the water and the atmosphere, and it all interacts in a complex way.
Professor, when we sometimes in the wintertime have a big snowstorm here, some of the television stations react with pieces that say, global warming's not real, it's snowing out, look how cold it is.
I think there's a difference between weather and climate, so the fact that the climate is changing, is warming, doesn't mean you cannot have snowstorms anymore. You just need to keep on explaining this to the public, that one thing doesn't exclude the other. And if that's a difficult message, you just need to repeat your message.
Especially in New York, with Wall Street not very far from where we are on this boat, I think people, economists, would understand that, you know, long-term trends of the stock exchange, you know, the value increases over time, but you can have these sort of momentary glitches like the 2008 crash, which, you know, in climate terms, you could have a sort of short cold period, whereas the overall trend is still a warming trend. You see?
Well, Professor, you just mentioned Wall Street, and we're not far from Wall Street. We're only around the corner here in a part of New York Harbor. Somebody has to make it so that you can make millions off of these solar cells that are lining this boat. Maybe you can make a little bit of money now, but not a lot of money. Wall Street needs to love these solar cells. How's that going to happen?
In some instance, I would probably bet more on economics than politics to start resolving some of the climate issues. You know, if a big firm understands that by reducing its carbon emissions, that's to say changing its energy use, they can still remain competitive, or maybe even more, become even more competitive because they're producing better for less energy use, then that's a message that can come across fairly quickly. So you need to, of course, to invest in the new energy technologies.
We say around here, follow the money, but I guess in this case you have to follow the money at 5.5 knots.
That's right, yeah.
No, but there's another aspect, you know. We cannot afford to wait until we know everything, because it's going to be too late. It's very difficult to change direction at the last moment. You need to act sooner.
All you need is the sun. As Planet Solar continues to raise awareness of energy sustainability and autonomy, visit our website, thetakeaway.org, for an exclusive video cut from the boat's trip around the Gulf Stream.
The end of the world is coming.
It was predicted thousands of years ago.
See ya!
A reverse polarity sunspot.
Goodbye!
There is no such thing as death. Life is only a dream.
This is the end. Beautiful friend.
Ah, the end of the world. You hear it there. It was supposed to have come at the end of 2012. We're still here. Well, writer, comedian, and resident Daily Show expert John Hodgman began a project several years ago, a comprehensive compendium of world knowledge. He wrote books like The Areas of My Expertise, More Information Than You Require, and ultimately, That Is All. And then John Hodgman disappeared from public view into seclusion and emerged a deranged millionaire.
I have time now to pursue my hobbies, my deranged millionaire hobbies, such as taking my shoes and socks off in public in order to make you uncomfortable, hoarding my own urine, growing my fingernails real long, getting there. And of course, I now have time to stretch my long fingernailed hands to probably the most important deranged millionaire project in my life, which is preparing for the end of the world.
Now, John Hodgman and his readers have been preparing all along for the end of the world. In his new special, he documents the last night of his doomsaying tour. That special is called Ragnarok. It will be available exclusively on Netflix tomorrow, June 20th. And John is here with me in the studio to talk about his special and other topics. Hi, John.
Hello.
Very good to have you. The most pressing
issue... I am glad that you are alive and the world didn't end.
And therein lies my first question, the most pressing one. What is Ragnarok and why should I be concerned?
Ragnarok is so many things. It is the mythological end times story of Norse mythology. It is probably the most difficult Netflix comedy special to pronounce. I chose it well. And I adopted it for my description of the sequence of end times events that I described in my book, That Is All, sort of following the cue of the Mayan prophecy, or rather the Mayan long count calendar that was ending, we reckoned, on December 21st of last year, 2012, and had inspired a lot of people to think that maybe something terrible was going to happen, that the Mayans knew something. And so I went into a deep trance and took my asthma inhaler 50 times and bathed in absinthe and came up with a host of predictions of what was going to happen during this doomsday year of 2012, including, obviously, ecological disaster, economic collapse. I explained to people as I went from town to town how when the U.S. dollar collapsed, the only currency that would have any value would be the beef jerky dollar. Once there was no more society, that's the only thing that would have any value. And then I foresaw other dark calamities, the rising tides, obviously, but also the blood wave, a giant tsunami of blood of mystical origin, and the Omega Pulse and the dog storm.
Dog storm, I recall, which was terrifying, which was every dog in the country coalescing into one gnarling, snarling pack.
Massive super dog pack.
That's dog storm.
That is the dark fever dream of every dog owner or dog adjacent human.
I recall you calculating the size of dog storm in surface area, and it was 18 square miles. I don't remember for
that,
sure.
That's about right, actually. It was one of the best afternoons I spent in my life consulting with Twitter. I got to go to Twitter to ask, what would you estimate the size of this pack would be? And I think it came down to 18 square miles. I mean, obviously, contemplating the end of the world is terrifying. But there is something cathartic about imagining worst-case scenarios. And I started thinking about the end of the world when I turned 40 not long ago. And that's, I think, when most people start contemplating the end of the world, because we are narcissists by nature, at least to some degree. And when we hit 40 and start contemplating our own mortality, the apocalypse story becomes perversely pleasurable because it suggests that, well, I'm so important to the Earth that when I go, I'm going to take the rest of the world out with me.
So many months later, with the world still here, Netflix is distributing your special. And it is you've commented on this, and it is interesting, sort of the new way in a media distribution sense that work like yours, work of comedians or humorists,
yes,
is being distributed. Netflix is making this available for a certain amount of time. This is a new kind of viewing for people.
I don't know that there has been a comedy special that has come out through Netflix before, but there are now dozens and dozens of ways that we get our filmed entertainment, we get our culture of all kinds, whether it's comedy, television, movies, music, books. You know, now that so much is coming to us digitally, we can get them through all different sorts of venues, and we can pick and choose what we want. We ran cameras on this last performance of mine on Ragnarok 2012, in part because I wanted to put everything onto a thumb drive and shoot it into space before midnight for posterity so that aliens could know our culture.
Like Voyager 2.
But then I guess I was hedging my bets a little bit. But I wanted there to be a record of a show that I had almost developed accidentally while touring my book, That Is All, and then it gradually developed into a one-man unscripted 1-hour-long comedy show. And so really I did kind of want to keep it for posterity. And then we were talking to Netflix. They said, let's release it. And I was thrilled because that's one of the great libraries of culture, emerging libraries of culture of our time. And I was so glad that the people who would be interested in seeing it would be able to get to see it.
In the podcasting part of your cafeteria, before we let you go, John.
No, please.
As a fan of Judge John Hodgman, to have
to have the
judge here himself is a thrill for me. Now, this is a real scenario. I just wanted to get your ruling on
Please. This.
And this is real Justice John Hodgman. Circuit Judge Royce Taylor in Rutherford County, Tennessee, we're told, said he was fed up with female attorneys wearing sexy clothes in his courtroom, things like short sleeve jackets that reveal elbows.
Oh,
he also thought sweatpants were a little too sexy for the courtroom. Are these, in your opinion, your constitutional legal opinion, are these clothes actually sexy? And as a corollary, should there be a dress code for courts in the circuit?
Well, I think that is pretty sexy and that's pretty provocative. But, you know, that's me. I'm an elbow man. I've always been, you know. But I will say this. I think that this judge is out of his mind. Sorry, Royce. But just as a clock that is stopped is right twice a day, so his opinion and my opinion have coincidentally overlapped on the issue of sweatpants, which should never be worn.
Never, ever.
They are designed for athletics. You should wear them in an athletic context or beachside or poolside or any time you might be thrown into a body of water or break a sweat. That's why you need those pants, for leg sweat. Anytime you start wearing any elastic waisted pant, trouser, pantaloon, knickers, anything like that, you are announcing to the world, I give up.
Yeah, that you're done.
I'm done.
John Hodgman is not done. In addition to his stint, which you just heard, on the Supreme Court as Associate Justice John Hodgman, he is the reclusive millionaire and the mind behind Ragnarok, his special, which premieres on Netflix tomorrow, June 20th, available for your downloading pleasure. John Hodgman, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You can hear much more of my interview with John Hodgman. He spent some time with us. You can see it at thetakeaway.org. You can hear it, rather. There's some video, too. And we're asking you, how do you imagine the end of the world?
Hi, this is Judy from Everett. I dreamt that all the corrupt lawmakers and leaders would get sucked into the void, leaving all of us less intelligent, minimum wage earning taxpayers on our own to salvage what's left on our own.
Sucked into the void with Judy in this.
Hi, this is Roman calling from Redmond, Washington. And I think that the world might end the way it did in Independence Day, but without the happy ending.
Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Because, come on, if aliens actually wanted to take over this planet, they wouldn't mess around. They'd just do it.
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE always. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. He's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.